Now I would like to.
And now I would like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Gail from San Diego.
Hi, I'm Gail. I'm an alcoholic. And it's a pleasure and an honor to be here. Thank you, Christine, for asking me to speak. And thank you to my supporters up in the front row, my husband, my sponsee, and my husband's sponsee. Adrienne is actually my sponsor, her sponsor. So it's kind of a family affair going on tonight, which is a good thing because that's how we stay sober. We help each other. My sobriety date is June 20th, 1988. My home group is the Pass It Along Big Book Study, Wednesday night, and my sponsor is Judy A. Three very important things. So there you go. What it was like. First of all, you know what? Happy birthday to everybody. What a great celebration that was. Lots of years, lots of hope in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's fabulous. And I want to shout out to all the people that are listening on the streaming. I think that that's fabulous. AA has come of age in the internet world, and it's just to be able to rock the world is a phenomenal thing. And I feel very honored to be part of the message and part of the solution tonight. And I gave the speaker prayer, God make me a hit. So there you go. let's see, what it was like for me. You know, I was the youngest of seven. I grew up in the Bay Area, and it was a normal household. You know, my father was a bit of a heavy drinker. I think that there would be some people who would say that he was alcoholic. Certainly no one in my family would say it, but I think that my father was an alcoholic. He was a binge drinker, a heavy binge drinker. He would lose his car and on Friday nights. My brothers would have to pick him up at the bar. But everything was going great in my life. But I was a sensitive child. And I say this because at 7 years old, I was reprimanded for something. I forget what it was. And I had a brilliant plan, a brilliant solution, and for that feeling of being reprimanded and admonished, and I was going to commit suicide. And so and this was at seven, or maybe even littler, because I could fit under the bed, I remember that. And I climbed up on my father's dresser, and I got his aftershave, his Aqua Velva, and I, the good stuff, and I crawled underneath the bed, and I started to swig on the bottle, and I was just like, you know what, I'm just gonna go, and they're gonna feel bad, for beating me, which they didn't beat me, but it felt like a beating, and that was my first, I think, drink of alcohol, because I know there's some alcohol in that Aqua Velva. When I think about it, I don't know of another little child that does that kind of stuff. I was very sensitive. And so, when I was growing up, everything was pretty good. Although I did kind of hang out at another girl's house. And the reason I hung out at this little girl's house, I met her the first day of kindergarten. And her family was like the perfect family. And her mom made her lunches, and I was kind of a latchkey kid, but their house was really clean, and they had a swimming pool, and I remember thinking, God, if I was just in this family, everything would be okay. at 13, my world came crashing to an end. My father, who I was the apple of his eye, being the youngest, I was spoiled rotten by him, and he drowned in the San Francisco Bay. And at that point, I was just like, that's it. In my relationship with God, I was baptized. I was a Christian. And at that point, I was like, okay, that's it. You and I, God, are finished. So at 13, I basically severed the ties. And that's when I really started to drink and use. And I was a garbage can. I basically took whatever. My first drink was a Mickey's Big Mouth. you know, in the green glass, and I love that. And I had a little other stuff with it, and I was a blackout drinker from the very beginning. I blacked out that night. Yeah, I saw him pumping his fist in the back. Yes, and that's the way it was for me, pretty much. I was a blackout drinker. High school, it was kind of like schizophrenic. I was, you know, smoking dope and drinking Red Mountain wine until, you know, I puked. And then I was also on the pom-pom squad. And so, you know, I had this double life going. And that would continue probably from most of my drinking career, which was all right. I wanted to be a good person, but I just had this insatiable disease or feeling of uncomfortability that the only thing that could really make me feel okay was to be high, to be drunk, to be high, to just not be in my own skin. And I recall that from a very early age. So at 17, I got a boyfriend. Wasn't the first boyfriend, but it was the boyfriend. And he was a drug dealer, and I was 17, he was 27. And I brought him home for Thanksgiving, and my mother just about cried. But, you know, that's the way it was. And so we proceeded on a very illegal path. writing fraudulent checks, actually fraudulent IDs for all of us, moving a lot of cocaine. I was up in the Bay Area, and lots of guns, lots of cash, lots of drugs, and, of course, always the alcohol. And I was trying to attend college as well. I was trying to go to Foothill College up in the Bay Area and study English literature. And so that was interesting. You know, I knew that it was I was on a downhill run, but I was, you know, it was like too much to do. So I took a couple of geographics. I did a couple of trips over to Europe and stayed over there to try to clean up, you know, get out of the Bay Area, clean up. And, you know, that was just a booze-fueled, hashish-fueled, you know, let's see, the Eiffel Tower, stoned and drunk, the Matterhorn, stoned and drunk, the Seine, the river, stoned and drunk. I was, everywhere I went, I was stoned and drunk, and I really don't really recall too much of it. But that's just the way it was. So I ended up coming back to the Bay Area, and my family was just like, you know, you need to do something, Gail. You need to go somewhere and start maturing and getting on with life. And so they decided to move me up to Tahoe. My mom had a house up there, so they moved me up to Tahoe. Well, that was not such a good idea because for the next 2 years, I basically, you know, didn't go to sleep. And but I, you know what? Just like good alcoholics, we are we land on our feet. You know, we're able to regroup and give it a good try. And I landed a great job as the manager of a bar. I had no experience whatsoever, and it didn't matter. And I did that for about 2 years, and that was great. My first experience and introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous was actually up in South Lake Tahoe. I was waiting at the bar for my drug dealer to show up, and I had an unlimited bar account, which was great. And so I was waiting and waiting and waiting, and the person didn't show up, and because that was my first treatment for alcoholism, really, I was the cocaine. I was a blackout drinker, as I said, and so I was driving home, and I missed the turn and drove into a railroad tie fence in my Volkswagen and went through the windshield. I ended up at the emergency room, and from the emergency room, I ended up in jail, in the holding cell. And so there I was in the jail cell in my little gray dress, stilettos, blood all down the front of me. They gave me a reverse mohawk with stitches in my forehead. And I'm sitting in the cell. It's actually not a cell. It was kind of like a waiting room. And I was sitting in there, though I was confined. And I was just screaming, you know, let me out of here. I don't belong here. And I hear this. I hear some women in the back, actually in behind the bars, going, shut that the up. And I'm like, okay, I am not going to stay here anymore. And so I finally got a ride out of there early in the morning, about 4 hours later. And I go home, and my brother and his girlfriend had been up all night. And, you know, I think a normal person would probably go upstairs and call it a day. And it was like 7 o'clock in the morning. And I went upstairs, changed clothes, and I came back down and poured myself a glass of Crown Royal, rolled a joint, did a line, and never missed a beat, you know. And I look back at that because it was really kind of a traumatic accident. It was, you know, the emergency room. It was, you know, police headquarters, and I had never been to police headquarters before. And, you know, it was just, but that's the way that I rolled. That's the way it was. And so, you know, and I had a boyfriend up in Tahoe, and that boyfriend was a big drug dealer too, and he ended up being murdered, and he was found in the trunk of his car up in San Rafael area. And that's the crowd that I hung with. It was dangerous, it was deadly, and I loved it. You know, I loved all of it. After Tahoe, you know, my brother was like, Gail, you really need to come back to San Diego. That's where he lived, and go back to school and get your degree. And so, you know, I don't know about you, but I did. I went to San Diego City College, and I was miraculously or fortuitously, I was able to do the news on Jazz 88. And so I started doing the news on Jazz 88 and going to school. And that was great. But the contract with my brother is that, you know, leave the drugs alone. And at this time, no one was saying anything about, you know, you have a drinking problem, even though they knew. But nobody said anything about that in my family, you know. And so I was going to school at City College, and I was doing the news, and I was off the drugs for 2 years. I was really doing good. And then one night, you know, one of the DJs said, hey, you know, do you do some coke? And I was off and running, and that was all it took. And, you know, but I was actually pretty good at doing the news on the radio, and I ended up getting a scholarship to the local station in San Diego, the CBS affiliate on KFMB Radio. And so I was doing the news on KFMB Radio, and that was really great. It was a great job. It was a great career. And then I transferred up to UCSD. But if any of you have drank the way I did and smoked dope the way that I did and drug the way that I did, you don't pass statistics and you don't pass biology. And I tried 3 times to go to pass those classes, and I could not do it. And, you know, And that's just the way it was, because I just couldn't get it together. And but I got through all the other classes. I just couldn't pass those. And so that's part of my drinking story, you know, is that I tried to go to college and I tried to graduate, but I just could not, because you really have to study to get past those classes. And so, you know, I did that, and I got the scholarship, and I was doing radio, and I was doing really well. And I just, you know what? I wasn't happy. There was no more huge traumatic incident in my life. I just got tired. By the time I was 30 years old, I was pooped. I was tired. I was tired of going to the liquor store, getting the booze, going to the ATM, drawing out the money, going down to the dealer's house, getting the drugs, coming home, drinking, doing it all. Going to the liquor store, going to the ATM, going down to that was my life on the weekends. And not only that, but I was driving in the news car, inebriated. And that's not a good idea. And then sometimes I take the news car down to a dealer's house down in Imperial Avenue, and there's billboards on the news car, okay? And the antennas, and then the lady back at the station, we'd be going, you know, like, where are you, K54, where are you? And I wouldn't answer for like an hour, and then, you know, I'd come back on the air, I'd resurface, and, you know, it was bad, you know, it was bad. And then I covered one news story. I went to a news conference, and it was at one of the hospitals, and they had busted some of the nurses for on-the-job drug use or something. But, you know, and I was in the back, and I raised my hand, and I asked a question, and I said, hey, you know, if they asked for help, would they have still have their job? And, you know, they said, yes, absolutely. If they would have sought treatment, they would have their job. So I buried that back in my head, and I thought, you know, because I loved my job, and I loved the people that I worked with, but I, you know, I was sick. I was very, very ill, and I didn't really know how sick I was. And that I love that in the book because it talks about that. We don't know really how sick we are, and so anyhow, so I, it wasn't. As I said, there was no big trigger that changed it for me. It was just that I was tired. And so I had been on a trip up to the Bay Area, drank a whole bunch of wine. We were up in the wine country, coming home, and I was just, I was tired. And I called, I think I called NA, and I called, I think I called AA, and I called another treatment provider, and it just wasn't, I couldn't get through, or I was put on hold, or whatever. And so I kind of gave up, and I went into work. And I remember going into work, and I had been drinking that morning, and I had been doing drugs that morning. And I went in, and I looked at myself in the mirror, and I was like, you know, I guess the gig isn't up. I got to keep going, and I don't know how to keep going, but I got to keep going. And so I went into work. And I was sitting at that time, because it was a long time ago, we had typewriters in the newsroom, and I'm sitting at my typewriter, and I'm trying to do a news story, and I just stopped, you know, and I walked into my news director's office, and I said, you know, I need to go to the hospital. I'm dying. And at this time, he's like, you know, and it turns out, you know, he's like, okay, we have insurance. I was part of a union. We have insurance, and we'll get you in. And he goes, do you want to work the rest of your shift, though? And I'm like, I'm like, no, I really don't want to work the rest of my shift. So then I called my roommate, you know, and I said, Gemma, I said, you know, I ratted on myself. I snitched myself out. She's like, oh, my God, what did you do? And I'm like, I told on myself. You know, I needed help, and I was so desperate. You know, I didn't talk to my family. My family really didn't think I had that much of a problem, certainly not with alcohol. Because it just wasn't recognized in my family. And so Jim was like, and I'm like, you got to come home straight after work. So she comes straight home after work, and she's still just like kicking me. She's just like, how could you have done this? How could you have told, you know? And I was just like, I got to stop. So I did my last Derringer thing, and I rolled a big fat doobie, and I said, stop at the 7-Eleven. I got a six pack of St. Pauli Girls Dark. And, because I really liked the girl on the front, and I liked Guinness. I had so much fun over in Europe, but yeah, I mean, I had fun out there. But anyhow, so I stopped and I got the St. Pauli Girls Dark, and I drank it. I said, you know what? We lived in Fashion Valley, and I said, you know, take the long way. I said, take Genesee all the way up to Scripps Hospital. So we went to Scripps McDonald Center. So she took Genesee the whole way, and you know, and I I think I drank half the six pack, and you know, smoked the doobie and did everything. And then I went into Scripps McDonald Center, and that was in May of 1988. And and that was my last drink. The St. Pauli's Girl was my last drink. And I got in there, and I was good for the first 24 hours, and then I woke up. Right? I was like, what did I do? Right? And I'm looking around at all these people in there, you know, and I'm like, ooh, God. So then I kind of went psycho, and they put me on Haldol for like a lot of Haldol, and so I sat on the couch for like 3 days, seeing double and eating ice cream. That's what I remember about Scripps McDonald Center. They just kind of like settled me down, right? Settle that woman down. So they settled me down, and then I wasn't going to get honest about my alcoholism. You know, I was a drug addict, but I was not going to get honest about my alcohol. I wasn't an alcoholic. You know, I know an alcoholic because my Aunt Mary was an alcoholic, and my Aunt Mary was the kind of alcoholic that would hide the bottles, or you'd come back and she'd be naked in the house. And, you know, that was my Aunt Mary. And she would get tight. They talk about her in the book. You know, she'd get tight right at the right moment. She destroyed her family, you know. I wasn't that kind of alcoholic. And I knew what an alcoholic was, and I wasn't going to say I was an alcoholic. And so they kept me in, I guess it's level one, and so they kept me there an extra week. And they said, you know, you need to get honest with us. Because when they assessed me before they brought me in, they made me tell a little bit of my story. And they said, yeah, you got a problem with alcohol. And so after a week, I kind of did get honest. And I knew that alcohol had always been my best friend. It had been my first choice, and it had been my last choice. Even when I came down back, when I moved back down here to San Diego, you know, and my brother said no more drugs, I knew I was going to be okay because I had the booze. And so that was a real big deal for me. And for the first year and a half in AA, I went to the other program too. And I would always introduce myself as an addict alcoholic. And you know, finally, you know, and I'll get to that, but my sponsor at the time, she was like, okay, we're going to stop that. We're going to nip that one in the bud. So I went to Scripps McDonald Center, and I ended up getting sober. And from Scripps McDonald Center, I had this counselor, and her name was Nora Dearhart, and she has passed on, and she was part of the program. But I called her Nora No Heart because I hated her, and because she had my number. From the moment I walked into her room, she knew what type of person I was. She called me out every time, and I didn't like her. And then when I wanted to get out of there, after 30 days, I was like, okay, I want to go back to my job. I got a great job. I'm not like the rest of the people in here. I have a good job. I have a condo, and I have a car. And I want out, and I want to go back to my life. And she's like, no. Mm-mm. She goes, you'll crash and burn. You're going to go out to Rancho La Brea. I don't want to go. So then she brings my family in right for family night. And so my family comes in for family. And this is my family. My mom and my brother are the ones that show up. I think one of my sisters. You know, and they ask them, in I think some kind of documentation, to please refrain from any mind-altering substances before you join. You know, you come in for the family group. You know, so in the middle of family group, you know, my family's kind of being inappropriate. And they said, you know, has anybody had anything to drink? And they, like, raise their hand. Like, yeah, we did, you know. And I'm like, yeah, that's my family. So, but my mother is like, you know, honey, why don't you listen to this counselor and just do it. Just go. Just go for me. And, you know, and my mom, I love my mom dearly, and she's still living. So I did. I went out to Rancho La Brea. And so I'm out at Rancho La Brea, and I stay out there for 30 days, and I love it, you know. I love being out there. It's beautiful. While I was out there, I got a hold of my higher power. Now, I had told you I lost my father, and I really had a problem with God. And there's anything that I can talk about tonight and leave you with, I think, especially for the newcomers, for me it was a real big deal, this thing with God. And it's been a kind of an evolution of my relationship with God in here and the higher power that I've come to understand. Out there, I had a real hard time. I was like, you know, you don't know, my God let me down. My God took my dad from me when I was 13 years old, okay? And, you know, that's still painful that I lost my dad, you know, that young. And so I always like to tell the men in the room, you know, if you have a daughter, you know, my dad left me. And he died, and I forgot to mention this, he died in an alcohol-related boating accident. He fell overboard and drowned. And so I always like to tell the men that, you know, I am the result of an alcoholic father who left me. I didn't turn out too bad, but it would have been so sweet if he would have been here with me. So I just like to leave that with the men in the room. Not a big guilt trip, but just enough to kind of nudge you, okay? my oldest brother had to walk me down the aisle, which I love him dearly, but I just, you know. So I go out to Rancho La Brea, and I love it out there, and I'm doing really well, and I end up, so then I got to go to a recovery home. And I'm not going to any recovery home. Remember, I'm like, you know, I'm like special. And so I go to this recovery home where there's one other woman, and there's a cook, and there's a mental health person, and a maid, and right? And the only other woman's there, she gets drunk. And so then there's just me, right? And that's not cool. And so it turns out not to be a very good recovery home. So I last there a month, while I'm out at Rancho La Brea, I go back to visit a girlfriend out there, and I see this guy out there. And I've got like, I think I've got 60 days. I go back out to see a girl, get a 30-day token. I might have 90. I have 90 days. Because I go back out after I get out of Rancho La Brea, and I see this guy, and I'm like, oh, my God, I'm in love. And I am a 90-day wonder, and I'm ready to share my life. And I'm so ready to share my life, my newfound life. And anyhow, so I see him. I'm like in love. And so then he leaves, you know, and I don't see him. But the most important thing is while I was out, I got sidetracked. But while I was out at Rancho La Brea, I'm sitting in a therapy room, and we're all talking about you got to believe in something, Gail. You got to find your higher power. And at the time, the people in the group said, you know, we believe. And then the therapist was like, you know what? Just believe that we believe. Just do that. Just believe that we believe in a higher power. And so that's what carried me for, you know, a long, long time, is that the group told me, and the group was living proof to me that things were changing in their lives and they were getting better. And so I went with that, you know. And so then I get the sponsor. I see her at Scripps McDonald Center. She's got this Capitol Record satin jacket on, and you know, my mentality is, oh, she knows musicians up in Los Angeles, and I want her to be my sponsor. And so I ask her to be my sponsor. She doesn't know any musicians, she doesn't know any rock and roll bands, and she's part of the Pacific Group up in Los Angeles, okay, which for some of you who don't know, it's, you know, what I consider like a militant AA group. But you know what? That's God worked in my life. That's what I needed. I needed strong AA. And you know, and I thank God every day that she came into my life. And she, you know what? She's always told me, if AA asks you to do something, you do it. When you're asked to speak, you wear a dress. You get to the meeting early. When you see a newcomer, you extend your hand. You sponsor women in Alcoholics Anonymous. You call your sponsor. You work the steps. You know, she taught me that basic stuff. I was force-fed that stuff, and I had to go to La Jolla Speakers for the first year and a half, and you know what? I don't go to that meeting today. I mean, it was a great meeting, and it was good for me, and I needed to be there, but I had to be there every Saturday night, and I had to go out to dinner with them. And, I got a little resentment on that one still, but... But you know what? Anyhow, so I see this guy, and then I get involved in the fellowship. And if you're new, please get involved in the fellowship. I went to conventions. I went to dances. AA became my new life. And, you know, for those of you that are new, you know, you gotta change. I changed everything. I changed friends. I changed everything. You gotta start new, and it's a new beginning. And it's a wonderful thing. But first, you know, I was full of contempt when I go to the AA dance. And I remember I was at one dance. My girlfriend's like, come on, let's go. And I'm like, ugh. So we go, and I'm sitting in the back, you know, and I'm judging everybody the way they dance. And, you know, I'm like, this is, you know, lame, and why am I here? And then all of a sudden I look on the dance floor, and who's on the dance floor? It's that guy from Rancho La Brea. I'm like, oh, things got interesting now, okay? So then I go, you know, I start sauntering over, and hi. He's like, do I know you? I'm like, yeah, we met, you know, Rancho La Brea. He's like, oh, yeah. So then we talk, you know, and I give him my number, and I'm thinking, okay, sobriety, you know, 90 days, looking pretty good, you know. And he calls, and we're off. Okay, we are off. It's beautiful. And I found out, you know, Isaac, he was the pathfinder, right? He's a pathfinder. anyhow, you know, and I forgot to tell you, when I was driving around in that news car in the radio news business, I'd go up to cover murders up in Golden Hill in that area back in the 80s, and I'd see all those men out on the front porch smoking cigarettes, and I didn't know what the house was. I didn't know, and I'd go, oh, those poor men. They all live together, and they hang out on the front porch, and oh, my God. How sad is that, you know? Just a bunch of them, you know, old and on the front porch. And so then I meet this guy, you know, on the dance floor, and I start talking to him, right? Where does he live? Pathfinders. So I'm like, okay. But, you know, it's good. But after 8 months, I hadn't really, you know, I didn't understand what it was to be in a relationship. And after 8 months, he had a little more time than me. He had about 9 months or something. You know, we almost had a year. And
between the two of us. And he's a little more sober, a little healthier, and because he's living in an institution, and we're at spoon fed to him daily, along with his three hots and a cot, and I am out there working, and so he leaves me, and he's like, you know what, this isn't right, this relationship isn't good, it's not healthy, I gotta go, and so I'm pretty upset, and so he leaves, and you know what, I throw myself into the steps and throw myself into a relationship inventory, and I just throw myself into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I realize is, after he left, that God, I really loved him. I really loved him, and I had to let him go. And it was one of the hardest things in sobriety, and let him go, and just threw myself into the AA. And I stayed sober, and I helped women, and then my sponsor moved away, and I got a new sponsor. And some of you may know of her. Her name was Corinne Chaney. She's since passed on. She died with 50 years of sobriety, and she was my sponsor, and I loved her so, so much. She was a loving sponsor. And so, I threw myself into AA, and 2 years later, I'm at a conference, because I go to conferences too, and AA conferences, and I'm on the dance floor, and I'm dancing it up, and someone taps me on the shoulder, and it's that guy, and unbeknownst to me, we had both thrown ourselves into the program, and he came back and asked me to dance, and we started dancing, and then the next morning I called my sponsor, and I'm like, you don't know who I went home with last night. You're never going to believe it. She's like, I know who it is. And so, and that turned out to be Rob. This is a funny story, because we moved in together, and then he asked me to marry him. And I said, we're going to live together for a year. And so we lived together for a year, and it was bliss. And, he was my fiancé, and life was good. And I'll tell you, I think like 3 days before the year was up, we started like fighting like cats and dogs. Cats and dogs. And finally we're sitting at the kitchen table, and I'm just bawling, and he's crying. And we're like, what is wrong with us? What's going on with us? And it was, we were both so afraid to commit. Didn't know how to do it. Weren't sure. That's what sobriety has done for me. I've grown up in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I learned how to have a relationship. I learned how to be a wife. I learned how to be a good employee. And in the meantime, we got back together, and as I said, he asked me to marry him, and once we kind of found out what the real stuff was going on, we acknowledged it, and it was all right, and it was okay, and we set the wedding date. In the meantime, I got promoted, and then I went into television, and I was the investigative reporter for Channel 8 News, and I was able to go back to UCSD, and when you're sober, you can get a tutor, and you can go to lab, and you sit in the front of the room, and you actually open the book, and you read it, and you make friends with the smartest people in the class, which is everything that I did, and I passed statistics, and I passed biology. I think I got an A- in biology. I found out that I loved science, and thank you. And I got a B+ in stats, and I went back, got my degree, and I think that was at 8 years of sobriety. It took me a while. So I worked for Channel 8, and that was a great gig, really fun. Investigative reporter, won all kinds of awards. Another thing that has happened for me in sobriety is that the success has been very, very hard to handle. Because a failure, I can handle failure. I know failure. But the success was a little bit more hard to take in. And I remember I went to a news awards program, and I won like 5 awards or 6 awards. And I remember coming home in my car, and I was just crying. I was just, couldn't put my finger on exactly what was going on. And then it was joy. It was just joy, And those things that I've been able to do, I've learned to identify some of my emotions, you know. I have since, you know, as I mentioned, I struggled with God a lot. And my husband and I tried to have children, and we couldn't have children, and we tried in vitro, and I got pregnant, and then I lost two babies. And then I really hated God. And so then that wasn't very good. And then my sponsor died, his sponsor died. My sponsee died. His sponsee died. We've buried a lot of people in alcohol. His mother died. His uncle died, who's like a father. And those were really dark times in sobriety, you know, and we walked through them. At 10 years of sobriety, and I like to talk about this from the podium, I went into a deep, deep depression after I lost the babies. Deep. And I was in a depression for a year before I would even talk about it. And I finally sought outside help. And I say that from the podium because that's my experience, and I needed help because I was suicidal at 10 years of sobriety. And you know, it's just my story. And the good news is that I sought help, I got help, and I was able to stay sober. I decided that I wanted to start climbing mountains, and I climbed Mount Whitney. And yeah, I did that. That was an incredible experience. And then this past year, in February last year, I climbed Mount Kilimanjaro and I summited Mount Kilimanjaro. I also, you know, if you did the math, I'm 54 and I'm in a rock band now, so which is really crazy, but it's really fun. And, you know, it's like I'm having the time of my life. And they talk about that in the big book. You know, we get sober, and then we have, and then we go, we grow, you know. And all that drugs and all that illegal activity, you know, I was fortunate. I got laid off from Channel 8, and that was the best thing that ever happened to me. I didn't know it at the time, but you know what? I had enough sobriety to trust the process and know that when God closes one door, he reopens it. Oh, and I just have to go back to Kilimanjaro. When you're at 19,364 feet, you get very close to God. And I have come very, my circle about God and everything has come full circle. And I have a very good, trusting relationship with God today. It's a very deep relationship. And, you know, Buddhism, I also took up Buddhism, and Buddhism has helped me immensely with meditation, and yoga has helped me immensely with meditation. I couldn't meditate before until I started doing yoga, and that has helped me immensely. So anyhow, so I get laid off from Channel 8, and before I know it, I'm working on campaigns, and I'm working on, in 2003, I'm working on a campaign for the district attorney, and she's an old friend of mine, old acquaintance from work, a professional, and she wins, and I go to work for her as the communications director for the district attorney's office of San Diego County. 5 years, I did that for 5 years, and 4 years ago I decided that I would, I wanted a new job, and so she let me create a position, and that was legislative liaison. And now I am the legislative liaison for the San Diego District Attorney's Office. And I go up to Sacramento, and I work on public safety laws. Public safety laws, that I helped ban a substance. It's called cathinone. And, you know, I mean, 30 years ago, I was probably trying to look for it. And today I'm passing laws to ban it. It's just amazing, the full circle, you know, and I have the trust of the people that I work with. I'm a respected member of my executive team. And, you know, and none of this could happen without my sobriety. None of it. None of it could have happened. You know, I have a great sponsor today. I have great women in my life. You know, we don't have the children, but we've got two Chihuahuas, and we got a German Shepherd, and we got a cat. So Ziggy is the German Shepherd, and Ramon and Carmelita are my Chihuahuas, and Dulce Diablo is our Baja cat that we smuggled back. Shh. And so you know what? Life is very sweet today for me. Life is sweet, and it's sweet because I'm sober. And you know, and for the women in the room, I just urge you to stick around for the miracles, because it just gets better. It really does get better. I don't know what else, I mean, life is so good for me today, you know, and it's a direct result because I do service, and I'm here when people want me. And it may not be convenient, but you know what? I was taught good AA, and I'm very, very grateful for it. And so for all of you that are new, I just hope that you stick around, and God bless you, and thank you for allowing me to stay sober another day.